All right, we got another tag team coming up, which is, in particular, looking at some of the particular concerns of stormwater infiltration in wellhead protection areas, source water protection areas, drinking water supply management areas, and other areas of concern. Steve Robertson from the Department of Health will be, he's the supervisor of the source water protection unit there at MDH. And by the way, I've made the decision not to rattle off everybody's degrees and such. You can look it up if you want to, okay? So, he'll be joined by Brad Skleeter with Stantec, and who is, and they'll be tag teaming it. And that's all I got to say. Take it away, boys.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here this morning to tag team on a presentation about stormwater infiltration within wellhead protection areas. And you know, we appreciate where we're the place at which we're appearing in the on the schedule here today. Not only are we aware of the fact we're right before lunch, and so that any applause that we garner may be due more to relief that we're done and you can get on to lunch than to any value associated with the presentation. But we also recognize, you know, some of the information that was presented in some of the presentations before us, notably with regard to the hydraulics of water flow in the landscape. You know, Lanya talked a little bit about infiltration, and we're going to kind of adopt a similar definition with regard to infiltration. We're talking about water. We're mainly concerned about water that's moving from the ground surface down and recharging groundwater systems. And with regard to what George was talking about, you'll see that we're concerned about the unique characteristics of infiltration within certain kinds of karst and solution enhanced environments, and so some of our policy guidelines have to do with that. And lastly, you know, with regard to what John and Mike just talked about, we're concerned about some of the quality issues associated with stormwater and the infiltration of that stormwater within wellhead protection areas. So, you know, a lot of those kinds of, you know, Mike characterized them as known unknowns. You know, I think about some of that as kind of uncertainty. And from a public health standpoint, you know, drinking water protection standpoint, we're kind of interested in trying to minimize the risks associated with unknown factors on in the management of water, and so that's in large part what led to the development of the guidance that will be that I'll be presenting here, kind of from a policy standpoint, and then Brad will follow along and talk a little bit about the practice of applying that policy within the real world environment. First off, I'm going to say that, you know, relative to stormwater, I'm with Calvin here. I don't know a whole lot about stormwater management. I come from a groundwater background. I've for the last several years, I've been working at the Minnesota Department of Health, working on as a groundwater specialist in helping to manage drinking water protection issues associated with within a public health framework. And at the Department of Health, we work on protecting drinking water within the overall regulatory framework of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, and that's a federal act that the Minnesota Department of Health has delegated authority from the EPA to implement in Minnesota. And I think it's important to point out that our focus from a clean water or from a Safe Drinking Water Act standpoint is really on the finished water product that public water suppliers deliver to your tap every day. And our authority really exists to regulate the public water suppliers in their operation of the engineered infrastructure that they use to deliver that water. So that's the wells, the distribution system, the storage systems, the treatment processes, and the folks that manage those systems. But from a source water standpoint, we're really interested in the world outside of that built infrastructure. It's the natural environment, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. But before I do so, you know, within the overall framework of drinking water protection, we generally take a what we call a multiple barrier approach, where we're trying to implement various overlapping ways of protecting drinking water supplies so that we can maintain that integrity over time. Most of you probably have kind of a passing familiarity with the Source Water Protection Program in Minnesota, but you know, very briefly, for those of you who don't, as I just indicated, Source Water Protection is one of many programs that the Health Department uses to implement the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. And it refers both to wellhead protection planning and to intake protection planning. And I'm not really going to talk a great deal about intake protection planning. That has to do with surface water resources like Minneapolis and St. Paul use. I'm going to primarily focus on wellhead protection because that refers to that pertains to groundwater-based systems that the vast majority of the public water supply systems rely on for their source of drinking water supply. And as I indicated before, the term source is used in a variety. The term source is used in a variety of different ways when we talk about source water protection. Some folks talk about the wells that are used to supply the water. In the Source Water Protection Program, we also extend that to think about the aquifer, because that's what we're trying to safeguard over time using the approaches that we use that we encourage public water suppliers to implement. Our focus is on the natural environment. Where those resources exist. And our intent with source water protection is to safeguard the drinking water supplies by managing potential sources of contamination so as to prevent problems down the road. And our emphasis is primarily on protection and prevention rather than restoration or reaction. And this is, I realized in the, you know, and it was just recently Easter, so I didn't realize that the pastels and the shapes here were going to conjure up that kind of image for me when I was looking at this the other day. But just in broad brush, this is a conceptual idea of what a wellhead protection area is around a well. You can see the well there identified on the right side of the screen. And the yellow area around it is the wellhead protection area. And in a porous media environment, that wellhead protection area is usually delineated using a groundwater model and a variety of criteria based on the hydraulic conditions of the aquifer, but generally using a criterion of a 10-year time of travel. There's some exceptions to that, and there's some flexibility public water suppliers have, but we're interested that main wellhead protection area is often delineated using a 10-year time of travel criterion. But we also delineate what we call an emergency response area, and that's that kind of red area around the well, and that's the area that we use the same set of conditions to delineate that, but that's a one-year time of travel area around the well. And the importance of that will become clear in a moment here. Wellhead protection planning is mandatory for public water suppliers in Minnesota. And when I say that it's mandatory, what that means is that when we bring them into the wellhead protection program, they must conduct wellhead protection planning. That means that they need to engage in the delineation of these areas. They need to develop active measures that they can implement to safeguard their resource, their aquifer, over time. And so they need to build a plan around those measures. They also need to implement that plan. It's not enough for them just to develop it and stick it on the bookshelf. This is a little bit of a problem for us because many public water suppliers have difficulties in implementing their plans for a variety of reasons. There's lack of resources. There's a lack of will on their part. They just don't understand sometimes the value of some of the protective activities that we ask them to engage in. And there's often a lack of appropriate authority. Get at some of the issues that I was talking about before. But as a result, we try to implement encourage implementation in a number of ways. We have a grant program to remove some of the financial obstacles. We have a number of staff involved in wellhead protection planning, and partnerships with folks around the state to try to lend technical assistance to public water suppliers to help them understand some of the value associated with the measures that in their plans. And this is relatively easy for us when we are working with them to implement measures around things that we understand real well, things like wells. At the Health Department, we directly regulate the construction of wells, and it's something about which we have a lot of information. So for us, it's kind of low-hanging fruit. But other kinds of potential sources of contamination in the landscape, like underground storage tanks or feedlots, septic systems, or stormwater infiltration devices. Those are things we don't directly control. And these may all represent a potential risk to the public water supply that neither we nor the public water suppliers have any real direct control over. So as a result, we rely on collaboration. And for us, collaboration means working with, recognizing that there are other players in the water resources management world, not only in Minnesota, but around the country. It requires recognizing that there are limits to what public water suppliers can accomplish on their own, especially if their wellhead protection areas extend beyond their property boundaries or outside of a municipal jurisdictional limit. Collaboration also means recognizing there's a lot of energy right now in Minnesota around water resources management. And it's devoted to improving water resources in the state, especially in the wake of the 2008 Legacy Amendment. So collaboration really means finding common ground and strategic alignments with others to enable good things to happen in the most meaningful places. And we like to think that wellhead protection areas on the landscape are some of those most meaningful places. So in this way, this presentation is a little bit of a story about collaboration. It's not only a collaboration between Brad and me, but it's a discussion of how we work with PCA and others to develop the guidance that I'm going to briefly go over in a moment. And it's a little bit of, and Brad's going to continue the story and talk about how he's used the guidance to, he's implemented the guidance in the real world. So I've been on this slide a little bit too long. What prompted us to develop our guidance, and what led to some of our concerns? Some of the earlier talks kind of suggested that some of the issues associated with that, but really we did this because of a longstanding concern about the potential for surface water to interact with groundwater. And I cite the example here of the wellhead protection area around St. Peter, where we know there's been, it's an example of where we've observed negative impacts from the interaction of surface water and groundwater. I can't see it. Okay, so the wells for the city of St. Peter, the main ones are right up in this kind of notch. The groundwater flow is towards the Minnesota River that's on the east side of the diagram. There's another set of wells down here. Actually, these have recently been sealed up and abandoned, so they have a new well field. But this is representative of the condition out there. And you can see that in the middle of the well field, I'm having a hard time working with this mouse with my left hand, but there's an escarpment here, and there's a big change that occurs on the landscape right along that escarpment. What happens to the west is that runoff from the agricultural fields and tile drainage in those areas collects in ditches and then cascades off of that upland, that till upland, onto the coarse-grained outwash terrace just to the east of the escarpment, and there it infiltrates into the groundwater system, and it has the high levels of nitrates in that surface water have contaminated the groundwater system there, and in fact resulted in nitrate contamination of the city's wells. So we, looking at this is kind of a natural analog to what we're talking about with regard to stormwater infiltration, where water is being collected on the landscape and is infiltrating in a small area in a focused way. So what are the characteristics of engineered infiltration of stormwater? Mike and others have talked a little bit about that. These practices are used to try to replace the natural diffuse infiltration that would occur in the natural landscape with when development results in the increased production of impervious surfaces. So in contrast to the diffuse infiltration that would occur in natural settings, stormwater runoff is collected and concentrated into focused areas. So we're concerned about the high volume events that produce a lot of water and potentially adverse water quality conditions. You've heard from others earlier today about some of the variations that occur in stormwater quality. And, of course, these were some of the concerns that drove us to develop the guidance I'll get to in just a minute. It varies. One of the things we've learned is that stormwater quality varies a great deal based on source area and climatic conditions, as John Gulliver told us about earlier. And this slide just shows a variety of the various kinds of contaminants that have been observed to appear in stormwater. And I'm really going to focus kind of, I mean, the last part of my presentation here is going to really focus on pathogens, the kinds of things that John was talking about, but we don't really have a great deal of information about. But they do have a potential, they are of concern to us because of their potential to create an acute public health effect. What's acceptable with regard to pathogens is a variety of different standards here. I'm just citing a couple of them. The World Health Organization has indicated that water intended for consumption should contain no pathogenic agents. Likewise, EPA suggests zero for all pathogens. What happens if pathogens do occur in groundwater or in water supply systems? There's a number of different examples here of disease outbreaks or contamination of public water supplies as a result of pathogenic agents. And one of them, the last one, was talked about by George earlier today. What can we do to avoid pathogens? We know some things about their viability in the subsurface. We know that that by and large they have a one-year lifetime in the subsurface. There may be some exceptions to that based on some of the recent virus work that's been going on in Wisconsin, but most of the work that we've done here in Minnesota and that the EPA has done has indicated that most of the pathogens only live for less than a year within the subsurface. We can try to protect ourselves by isolating sources of pathogens from receptors. Some techniques there for doing that, and we can either remove the pathogens or treat for them to try to prevent public health impacts. So our guidance was developed around some of these concerns. Our guidance is advisory. It's not mandatory. It's intended for use by professionals in the field, either at local units of government or other agencies or their consulting staff. It's a stepwise process. I'm not really going to go through it in detail, but the guidance as it exists is available on our website. But just a brief summary. Because of our concern about the acute effects of some of the pathogens, we want to try to avoid stormwater infiltration in close proximity to wells that are used as a source of supply for public water supply systems. So that means avoiding the infiltration in emergency response areas. This is an example of what an emergency response area looks like in the real world. And for the city of Renville, and the red area around the well that's in the center of the slide is the emergency response area. The blue area way outside that is the wellhead protection area. So you can see that these, generally speaking, these emergency response areas are fairly small. They don't represent a large area on the landscape. So, as I said before, our goal is to try to avoid stormwater infiltration within those areas because if the infiltration results in contaminants, namely pathogens, make it into the groundwater system, they would then have the potential to travel to the water supply well in a time frame that might allow for the viability of the pathogens. Item two with regard to the guidance is to avoid infiltration in wellhead protection areas in settings dominated by fracture or solution-enhanced aquifer conditions. And with all that George talked about earlier today, I think this is probably a self-evident concern. I do have a slide that kind of encapsulates for me some of our reasons for doing this. What we're concerned about is within these environments that the fluid flow in fractures or conduits is unpredictably rapid. So wherever it takes place within a recharge area for a well, the potential exists for water in conduits or fractures to move at a sufficiently fast rate that it will get to the public water supply well in a time frame that doesn't allow for the attenuation of the pathogens in any way. And this slide just shows a 6-foot diameter sump at the corner of the Kramer Quarry in Burnsville that they used to dewater the quarry. And you can see fracture partings in the Prairie du Chien there that are from which water is emerging at such a velocity that it's cascading off of the side of the sump and down into the borehole. So that's indicative of a fairly rapid fluid flow in that kind of environment. The third item is consider land uses. And this, I'm not really going to talk a lot about this today. There's a lot of been a lot of new information that's been developed since we put our guidance together 6 or 7 years ago. And so we may need to fine-tune some of our approaches with the, or our concerns with regard to how land uses contribute to stormwater quality and how that might impact our concerns with regard to infiltration in wellhead areas. But by and large, what we're talking about is, you know, being concerned about what the catchment area is that collects the stormwater from the landscape and being aware of how it's what potential impacts there might be from a quality standpoint. So just to wrap up and to hand the baton off to Brad here, I've got a couple of last thoughts. One is that, you know, we're not saying that infiltration is a bad idea. And in general, I think we recognize that stormwater or that infiltration plays an important role in the management of water on the landscape, and we don't think it's a bad practice. But we just think that there should be some common sense applied to where it's done on the landscape. And we want to make sure that we take the appropriate safeguards to protect drinking water sources. Because, you know, in the end, you know, whether we're working with groundwater that may become drinking water or surface water that may become stormwater, we're really wanting to think holistically and collaborate and worry about the water as an overall resource. And that's kind of, I guess, the last thought that I'll leave you with, and I'll pass it on to Brad.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'll not attempt to use the mouse with my left hand. I'll use my right hand. So Steve and I have had the opportunity to present this particular presentation a few other times at some other venues, both a stormwater venue and another groundwater-related venue, and it's just an important message to continue to convey this surface water and groundwater connection, both from a policy standpoint and then from a practical application standpoint. So what I'm going to talk about is practical implementation of the policy from the standpoint of stormwater management. So that's where I'm coming from. I don't have a groundwater background. I have a stormwater management background and have worked in the stormwater management world my whole career. So my whole career I've been... as my career has emerged, I've been starting to implement these policy practices into the design of stormwater BMP-type systems. And one of the policy implications that I have to deal with, and that's becoming more and more of a policy implication to deal with, is wellhead protection policy. So I wanted to cover a few things today. Namely, current regulatory environment when it comes to stormwater and infiltration. And Mike actually alluded to some of this in his presentation, but I'll go into that in a little bit more detail. Talk about the Department of Health guidance. Steve alluded to that in his presentation, but I'll come at that from an implementation standpoint on a surface water. And then lastly, just take one metro community and do a little bit of a case study on how they've dealt with this wellhead protection issue when it comes to implementing stormwater practices, because they have some particular issues that are unique to their situation but could be applied to other communities as well. So as far as the current regulatory environment, there's a number of different angles that are coming in terms of groundwater protection, and one of those is coming from the state MS4 permit. So not to go into this in too much detail, but the MS4 program is for most of the metro cities are MS4 communities. They're regulated under the MS4 permit. Larger outstate communities are also potentially designated as MS4 communities, and this permit regulates how they discharge stormwater from their MS4 system, their storm sewer system, their pond system. So I picked out just one of the segments of that permit as it pertains to wellhead protection. And you can see at the bottom there, I identified what the location is, and this will be on the test at the end. So part 3D5A3A1, it says this in terms of prohibition of infiltration within areas, industrial facility areas that, per their industrial permit, preclude infiltration. As Steve mentioned, you know, location and land use are important. Talk about vehicle fueling and where maintenance occur. When there's not sufficient separation between the bottom of the feature and seasonally high groundwater elevations or bedrock elevations. And then in situations where you've got high contaminant levels that could potentially be leach further into the groundwater system. And then also from that same document, the next section down, it talks about restrictions of infiltration where higher engineering review is necessary to sufficiently prevent adverse impacts to groundwater. So this is where the Department of Health guidance and other guidance documents help. We talk about this further information, this higher engineering review. You've got situations where the soils just won't allow infiltration. Situations where you've got karst and potential impacts to groundwater because of the karst situations. If an infiltration practice is located within a wellhead protection area or a drinking water supply management area. And then in situations where you've got really sandy soils that infiltrate very quickly for that same reason. Other avenues for regulatory environment, as Mike alluded to in his presentation, this basically the same language that I just read from the MS4 permit is included within the state's construction stormwater permit. Same information. Watershed management organizations in their rules and requirements have over the last probably 4 or 5 years began to include these impediments to infiltration as well within their rules and requirements. And then lastly, municipal well protection plans, again, lay a groundwork and a framework for where infiltration can be done and maybe it shouldn't be done, or at least it needs to be looked into in more detail. So not to get too much into detail about this, but again, Steve alluded to the chart or the flow chart from Department of Health, and this is the flow chart. So again, the areas of emphasis, you kind of start at the top of the flow chart, and is the infiltration BMP located in a well protection area? That's the first question, the first yes or no question. It goes on to say if it is yes, is it located within an area that the aquifer exhibits this fractured or solution-enhanced groundwater flow condition? Depending on that answer, if the answer is yes to that, infiltration is not a recommended practice. If it is no, then it goes on to say, is the infiltration feature located within that 1 year time of travel area? And then as you kind of work through the flow chart, it talks about proposed land use. Obviously, that has implications as far as the type of pollutants that are coming off a given land use. Do you have a response plan in place for if situations occur, if spills occur, what are you going to do about that? And then do you have adequate pretreatment measures in place? So you can see you kind of work through this flow chart to see if a given site is appropriate for infiltration or not. And then lastly, what I'd like to cover is a practical application of using this flow chart, using information from a metro community, City of Cottage Grove's wellhead protection plan, and the guidance provided, kind of putting all that together, and then some practical applications of how this turns out in the real world. So, Cottage Grove, located in southern Washington County, about two-thirds of the city is the nearest bedrock layer is exhibiting that fractured bedrock condition, Prairie du Chien. So there is kind of an immediate issue or concern when one looks at infiltration in most parts of the city. And the city has really taken that to heart and taken the approach of, we're going to take the steps necessary to follow the appropriate guidance out there when we're doing retrofit projects or new development projects as they come in. This is wellhead protection areas within the city. The traditional wellhead protection areas, the kind of oval, rounding-shaped areas around the city's well fields, located here and then a couple here. And then the larger, kind of oddly shaped wellhead protection area is actually a surface water connection to groundwater. So there's a basically what's going on in that situation is you've got about 5,000 acres coming in from the very southwest corner of Woodbury into the northwest corner of Cottage Grove, primarily single-family residential, large lot residential, that drains in a surface system through a series of depression areas, ponds, stormwater system, and basically comes down and through the system passes right next to a municipal well, well number 10. This is just a close-up of the very southern part circled in yellow there. The system prior to some improvements that the city made, it came through this Hamlet Park Pond. You can see this basin right here, which is right adjacent to Highway 61. That 5,000 acres of surface drainage drained through the system, left Hamlet Park Pond out a 24-inch outlet, and then disappeared into the surface bedrock. The direction of the groundwater flow was kind of following this dashed line right past well number 10. So what the city did as they were developing the Hamlet Park Pond area and they wanted to put in some more ball fields, we looked at that issue specifically from a groundwater protection standpoint and ended up installing, you can see the kind of darker areas here, a series of clay-lined channels and clay-lined ponding areas to allow that flow to come out of Hamlet Park Pond and basically pass past well number 10 to avoid the potential issues with being so close to that well. As far as new development, again, requirements are in place now that both from a regulatory standpoint and then just kind of city policy, when we are in situations where new development comes in, we end up both from a groundwater protection standpoint, lining stormwater ponds, also from an aesthetic standpoint, if a developer shows a blue blob on a product, some sort of advertisement for their development, in Cottage Grove, the soils are very sandy, and if they don't line the ponds, they end up being a big hole in the ground with weeds in it, and people buy really expensive walkout homes to be backing up to a nice blue stormwater pond as opposed to a big hole in with weeds. So there's both the groundwater protection side and the kind of practical application side and really angry residents calling up because they have a hole in their backyard and it's full of weeds. So new development standards. The city also, in an effort to provide improved water quality within their system, the system has traditionally been a series of dry stormwater ponds. There are a handful of wet ponds as well, but they've gone through a process of retrofitting their system to enhance their existing basins with more water quality improvements. So this is one particular example, some pond improvements in one of their dry stormwater ponds. It's a combination approach. So Mike talked about that treatment train approach where we've got prior to, again, this was just a dry stormwater pond. Stormwater was dumped in through outlets, made its way down to the lower end of the basin, and on down the way, basically with the only benefit being rate restriction, so it reduced pipe sizes downstream, and then whatever stormwater did infiltrate through the system was within a wellhead protection area. So the city was concerned about that. So we ended up putting in two locations of wet ponding areas that were lined with clay on the north end of the pond and then on the south end of the pond where there were large inlets coming in. And then down the center of the ravine, We put in a clay-lined biofiltration trench. So drain tile on the bottom, clay-lined. Here's a detail. So we've got clay on the bottom and then a soil compost sand mixture, so it allows for the vegetation to grow through, and then drain tile on the bottom to drain the system. Just a few shots of what that practically looks like in the field. Again, we've got the development of one of the two stormwater ponds, and then this kind of green area here is the turf reinforcement mat that we put in the bottom of the ravine to keep the soils in place as the vegetation was beginning to establish. This is what it looks like as it's beginning to fill in the next growing season. So you see the pond is full. We've got green vegetation coming in. It's beginning to come up through that turf reinforcement mat to really lock it in place and prevent the soil from eroding away. We've also got these rock check areas. So as stormwater comes into the trench system, it's being held up by these rock checks in an effort to get it to infiltrate down through the soil media and into the drain tile. This is just a close-up of what that trench looks like and one of the rock checks. You can see the cleanouts, those little green things with the caps on the top. Those are the cleanouts in the end to, again, make it a feature that the city can actually maintain. And if they need to go in there and clean those out, they've got cleanouts to do so. And again, vegetation's beginning to grow up through that turf reinforcement mat. Another situation where this is actually more of an aesthetic situation. The city, at an entrance to a park, they wanted to have a wet feature. So we put in a lined stormwater pond. Prior to that, it was a dry basin that didn't hold any water. So this was the detail from the plans, basically just putting in a one-foot clay liner. It's been a very effective tool for us to maintain water levels and prevent the ponds from draining out through the bottom. And then lastly, an example of a more recent stormwater improvement where we've got a combination stormwater pond at the upstream end of the system here. So about 80 acres of residential drainage comes in. The city was able to divert the one storm sewer pipe that this comes in from into a wet ponding area. And then that wet ponding area drains into an iron-enhanced sand filter. So this is the first time the city's implemented an iron-enhanced sand filter. If you've heard about those, it's in an effort to not only filter out the particulates, but it's also in an effort to the iron in the sand has the ability to latch on to the dissolved portion of the phosphorus as it's moving through that sand and iron mixture. And there's a lot of drain tile needed in that system. I was working on trying to find some guidance on how much drain tile would be needed in a system. I found a little bit, but as you can see, I ended up with a lot of drain tile. So we'll see how this thing, the idea is to keep the soil media dried out between rainfall events. So if this doesn't do it, I don't think it can dry out, honestly. This is just a photo of what that looks like constructed after the vegetation is starting to grow. Stormwater pond is filling up, and then on the left-hand side of the screen here, this is the vegetation beginning to grow up through that sand and iron mixture. We did put a layer of the sand and compost mixture to give the vegetation a little bit of something to grow into. And then just some final thoughts before we end here. From a stormwater standpoint, so I'm coming at it from that way. Well, protection concerns are real. That's why we're here. That's why we're talking about this stormwater-groundwater interaction. For communities out there, make sure that we know what the source water protection issues are facing your community, whether that's bedrock issues, particular land uses, whatever the case may be. There are impediments, things that need to be looked into more frequently in terms of stormwater infiltration. And as we're designing infiltration features, making sure that we're cognizant of both the surface water and the groundwater impediments. And then lastly, err on the side of caution when it comes to infiltrating stormwater, and just making sure that the approach to the process is one that places a priority on drinking water protection, as well as the benefits received in terms of water quality improvement. So that's all I had. I guess if there's time for questions, we'll take some.
One question.
One?
Yeah. You're it.
I was just wondering if you have a clay lined pond like most of your examples, do you still consider that an infiltration feature?
No. Nope. So the examples that were clay lined ponds are water quality ponding areas.